From WBUR Boston, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Steve Brown. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, we present the second of three installments from the annual lecture series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture is titled, In the Talmud and Other Sources, Satan in Ancient Memories. Introducing Professor Wiesel is Dr. Paula Friedman, Associate Dean at the Boston University Goldman School of Dental Medicine.
It is an honor and privilege to have been asked to introduce one of the great authors and philosophers of our time, Professor Elie Wiesel. I have attended his presentations over the past three decades and have experienced the profundity of his presence. When he writes, he is like a composer, blending the musical notes of life and history with the background and scope of his rich, erudite analysis. When he speaks, he is like a poet whose gentle voice and careful selection of thoughts, words, and phrases carries us, his rapt audience, to a higher level of appreciation and understanding of his weekly topic. As he himself urges us to do, we think higher and feel deeper. He is a humble man, yet empowered by courage, compassion, and conviction. I personally remember quite clearly in 1985 when President Reagan was scheduled to make a reconciliation trip to Germany at the invitation of West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl. The itinerary included a visit to Bitburg Cemetery, where Nazis were among those interred. With courage and determination, Professor Wiesel tried to dissuade the President of the United States from making that stop during the visit. Quietly, firmly, publicly, he said, "Mr. President, I implore you to do something else, to find another way, another site. That place, Mr. President, is not your place." Professor Wiesel's moral compass points true north. He is the conscience of those in the world who care about human rights, speaking out on behalf of those who cannot speak for themselves, pleading for justice for those from countries all over the world, from the Soviet Union to South Africa, from Bosnia to Darfur, from Biafra to Bangladesh. To further the vision that the world can and will be a better place to live, Professor Wiesel established the Elie Wiesel Foundation for Humanity. The foundation's mission, rooted in the history of the Holocaust, is to combat indifference, intolerance, and injustice through international dialogue and youth-focused programs that promote acceptance, understanding, and equality. This noble endeavor stems from one who himself has suffered the pain of indifference, intolerance, and injustice. Yet from the depths of darkness of his own personal experiences, he has arisen as a voice of hope, a source of light, and an agent of change. The very first conference sponsored by his foundation was held here at Boston University in 1989. The topic of that conference was The Anatomy of Hate. That visionary conference was held 20 years ago, yet hatred among and between peoples and nations still persists. But Professor Wiesel's work to transcend hatred endures. As he stated at one of the Foundation's conferences, the fact alone that we have gathered to face these problems together gives one courage. For surely we all agree humankind must be offered a right to hope and a better chance to remain alive and open to consultation. The title for this evening's presentation, in the Talmud and other sources, Satan in Ancient Memories, is of particular interest to me. At the end of this week, I leave for a professional journey to Russia and Poland. While in Poland, I will visit Warsaw, Krakow, and Auschwitz, the sites of tragedies and travesties of World War II, memories of which remain with us now and forever in history. Certainly, there were elements of hatred and demonization pervasive in those times, targeting people who wanted nothing more than to live their life in peace. This evening, we will be the beneficiaries of a more enlightened spirit, the reflections of a moral and ethical philosopher who will open our minds to learning about Satan in the world of long ago. I present to you, with deepest appreciation and respect, Nobel Peace Prize winner and the Boston University Andrew W. Mellon Professor in the Humanities, Elie Wiesel.
Thank you so much for your words. I'm told by Rabbi Pollack that you were here from the very beginning of my lecture series here. And maybe you remember them. I don't. I want to thank Provost Campbell and, of course, John Silver for being here tonight and study with us together. About a character who is so present. When you open the newspapers these days, there are so many satanic movements. They openly declare themselves as satanic. And you wonder, why are they attracted to Satan? All right, maybe we'll understand later on. But the first question, of course, who is Satan? Where is he? What is his function? What is his age? What is his appearance, his strength, his weakness? Why are we interested in him? Who are his friends, his allies? What and whom does he represent? How is one to describe and define him? As a source of vanity, of fear and terror, the father figure of evil, of destruction. Some sages see him as an eternal seducer. Others call him tempter. Said Rabbi Shimon, son of Lachish, Satan, the evil inclination, is also the angel of death. They are all one and the same. Clearly, he is the primary cause of hatred and suffering, anguish and agony. Wherever there is war, he is in it. Where there is evil, it wears his mask and his seal. Whoever hates strengthens his name. Chaos and pandemonium are his works, says Milton. True, but not entirely. His aim is also to establish his own order, his own language, his own culture. He is wherever human beings dwell alone or in society. In other words, he remains their clever, vicious, shrewd enemy since the beginning of times. With him around, no one is safe or immune. He is to be found in the lessons of imagination, as reflected in both ancient and modern texts dealing with the thirst of knowledge to acquire and the quest for faith to deserve. Christian, Muslim, Jewish, and agnostic references to him exist in abundance. You know them, John Milton, Blake, Daniel Defoe, and Goethe. They brought him into the magic universe of poetry and literature as a symbol of limitless deviousness and gratuitous cruelty. Originally, the name in our tradition means adversary, opponent, prosecutor, whose aim is to hurt, trap, threaten, and humiliate what is noble and human and dignified in men and women. In the Vulgate, he is called Lucifer. In Latin, he is Diabolos. In French, Diable. In German, Teufel. He is not in Scripture, not in the five books of Moses. But he uses Judas as an agent to denounce him into the Romans, to denounce Jesus in the New Testament as an agent of who knows what. In Islam, his presence is strong, stronger than in many other traditions, and frequently invoked. Some sources identify him simply with the evil spirit, the Yetzer Hara in Hebrew. What would the world be without him? What would life and human nature be without him? Without the inner struggle or spiritual challenge he imposes? Without the need or desire to oppose his goals? Rather uneventful, if not boring. We should almost say, thank God for Satan, who makes his creation a little bit more challenging. In Scripture, no major figure is faultless, no life without drama. Even candidates for sainthood need something of a Satan to attain it by resisting him with more or less determination. The Quran calls him Satan or Iblis and views him as one of the jinns or demons that were born of fire. Thus dangerous, devouring. His name is mentioned more frequently than many other saints in many, many texts. So last week, actually, here we encountered him in the book of Job. We shall return to him, to Job, I mean. But we have met Satan already earlier in the tale of the binding of Isaac. We shall come to him also. Where was he before the Akedah? If he existed, he was invisible. When God was considering the creation of man, we hear a discussion, a fiery discussion among angels. Some favored the project of having man, wagering on human virtues. Others opposed it, invoking human frailties. And Satan had nothing to say in the subject. He who intervened in so many primary events later kept silent before and during the very first debate. Why didn't he warn God against what his creatures will do with his creation because of him? And why didn't he play part in Adam's and Eve's extraordinary adventure with a certain serpent, leading to their expulsion and ours from the peaceful Garden of Eden? It would have been so simple to say, and Satan came, and he is the one who told Adam and Eve. The great Saul Lieberman Zal, my teacher, late teacher and friend, quotes a bizarre legend from ancient Slavic sources. Listen. When Adam and Eve saw the sun set for the first time, they got scared of the darkness. And what if they would never see light again? Suddenly Satan appeared before them with a deal. Satan is the great deal maker. And he said, if they promise to remain his servants, light will be returned to them. They agreed. He asked for a handwritten document. It read, we and our descendants will belong to you. We pledge never to disobey your orders. Which teaches us that Adam and Eve were not illiterate. It also teaches us that Satan was already there. But Satan disappeared. And the next day, of course, the first couple witnessed the new sunrise and the new sunset. They were happy. But then they realized that they had been Satan's gullible victims. Too late. Obviously, they were too young to understand that true darkness does not come from outside the person, but from inside. He, Satan, embodies darkness. And they didn't know it. Their Almighty Father should have warned them, but for obscure reasons, he didn't. Therefore, says that legend, we are still servants of Satan. Such cosmic theory of humankind being doomed by Satan's original cheat does not exist in Jewish sources. But some Midrashic sources do insist that Satan was not totally absent from creation. The problem exists because he has more than one name. There, at that time, he was called Samael. In that version, heavenly angels did try to dissuade the Creator from creating man, and they said, look at him, he's nothing but dust. How can he do something great and good? And God answered, what you do here above, he will do down below. He will sing my praise. Better yet, said God, can you name things? Can you name animals? He can, and he will. The angels surrendered, but Samuel was not one of them. He was not satisfied. As Samuel, Satan organized a rebellion, the first rebellion in the Bible. And Satan was punished. God threw him and his followers into hell. He wasn't too unhappy there, according to Milton. You remember what Milton said. Better be a master in hell than a slave in heaven. Some sources believe that unlike other angels, Satan refused to bow before Adam. Also, we are told that he is the one who pushed him and his wife to eat fruit from the forbidden tree, but it is not in the text. His next important target is strangely not Cain or Abel, but Noah, one of the rare survivors of the floods. Was Satan on his ark? Probably not. For the simple reason that all those who boarded the ark had to come in pairs. And Satan was a bachelor. But then didn't he have a wife? Lilith, the queen of the female demons? No, she may have been his accomplice, but not his wife. And if they were married, it's possible. But then they were afraid of seasickness. The fact is that they are not mentioned on Noah's guest list. When God ordered Noah to build an ark, his fellow citizens mocked him, not Satan. They just refused to believe that the end of their world was near. Were they subconsciously influenced by Satan? He personally appeared on stage only afterwards. You know this story. When the floods receded, Noah left the ark. His first symbolic gesture as first survivor was planting, starting again, doing something on ruins. He wanted to begin again, as if to tell the Almighty, in spite of everything, I have faith in you and in our common future. Or at which point Satan appeared before him and asked, what are you doing? Oh, I am planting, said Noah. What are you planting? A vineyard, said Noah. What is its nature? Asked Satan. Its fruit, said Noah, is good, whether fresh or dried. It is sweet. Wine is made from it. It gladdens man's heart. So Satan proposed a partnership. How about planting it together? Why not, said Noah? It's interesting. Noah is not a good businessman. He is not curious about his new associate. He didn't ask for credentials and references, and now he became his associate. He's not surprised to see a stranger before him. How could he be sure of his honesty? Logically, he should have asked him where he came from, at least where he came from, since all humankind disappeared in the floods. Was he perhaps an illegal passenger or a stowaway on his ark? He should have known, or he should have wanted to know. That Noah's timing is wrong, we know from his remarkable dialogue with God. The Midrash tells us that when the catastrophe was over, Noah asked God why he did not spare the innocent and the children. And God's answer was, now you are asking. How marvelous. Now you are asking. Why didn't you ask me before? Obviously, Noah accepts life as it is. Facing Satan, he takes him immediately, without any hesitation, as a full-fledged partner. Listen what the Midrash tells us next. What was Satan's next move? He brought a lamb and slaughtered it over the wine. Then he did the same with a lion, then with a monkey, and finally with a pig. That was his way of saying that when a man drinks one cup of wine, he acts like a lamb. When he drinks two, he behaves like a lion. When he drinks three, he acts like a monkey. When he goes on drinking, he acts like a pig. And Noah, he let him do all that on his plant without interference. Is it to teach us that Satan enters our life only when we look away or when we don't ask questions? What we have done in past years is what we are going to do today. We study texts and sources. Learning has been and remains our primary goal. This is our passion, the passion that brings us together. If until now we've brought great figures of the Bible, of the Talmud, and of Hasidic traditions, we decided tonight it's either or. Either Satan will come and speak about me, or I will come and speak about Satan. And I made the choice. Sages from most religious traditions believe, and want us to believe, that men or women are defined by their physical components and by their soul. Hence, we forever serve as their supreme and sometimes annoying battleground. Can we intelligently serve both? If one side wins, the other loses. In Talmudic literature, we are accompanied by two angels, all of us, the good and the wicked. And life means to celebrate the one rather than favor the other. It's our choice. It's not they choosing us. We choose our angelic companions. Usually we envisage Satan as the agent whose assigned or self-imposed task was and is to do everything in his power to influence man to go astray. He is the eternal other side, the dark side of light, of beauty, of reason, of truth, of hope, of humanity. He is the impure, the evil spirit, the nefarious instinct, the animal urge in all of us. He was there in Egypt who urged Pharaoh to persecute the Hebrews. Worse, he was among the persecutors. He can even be among friends, disguised. Better yet, he may pretend to be our best friend. Beware. His goal, to push us away from the noble aspiration to do something good, something special, something worthy, something learned, something noble, which allows the sacred to prevail upon the profane. Said Rabbi Helbo, wherever people are utterly satisfied, Satan is there. Don't be satisfied. As I always try to tell my students, when I came to America, the first thing I heard is, relax, relax. No, don't. I don't want to relax. What for? What good is it to relax? So don't be satisfied. Said Rabbi Levi, wherever people eat and drink instead of studying and praying, Satan is present. Meaning whenever they do nothing else than eating and drinking, Satan is in their midst. On the other hand, even when we do behave well, he is not inactive. Listen to Rabbi Acha. If and when just people live in peace in this material world, Satan protests to God, saying, isn't it enough that theirs will be the world to come? Must they also benefit from the terrestrial one, this one below? Said Rabbi Yose, one should never give Satan the opportunity to open his mouth. It is because he is stronger, cleverer, more erudite? No, because he makes things easier. When facing a crisis, a choice, the easiest option is often the one indicated by Satan. Too easy. Doesn't he exist in the life of a just man or a tzaddik? He does. Otherwise, it would be also too easy for them. For the just men, we are told, the most difficult time is the Day of Atonement, or Yom Kippur. That day, Satan presents a valid complaint to the Almighty, saying, why is it that throughout the entire year you allow me to do my work on any other human being, but not on just men and women? Why should they enjoy such impunity? Isn't it unfair? And God answers, try on Yom Kippur. For on that day, no one is perfect. And if someone thinks that he or she is, their vanity itself is a sin. Example, some of you may know that at the end of Yom Kippur, after the fasting, when all the litanies are done, we recite the usual evening prayer, Maariv. In it, we ask God to forgive us the sins we have committed. What? What sins? We just ended the prayers of Yom Kippur. What sins could we have committed between that prayer and this one? We are in the synagogue. And the answer is, to presume that is already a sin. One never knows. Said Rabbi Shimon, in the name of Rabbi Yoshua, why does the high priest not enter the Holy of Holies clad in garments of gold, befitting his high office and the solemnity of the occasion? When he will utter the ineffable name of God, he does so in order not to give Satan the opportunity of accusing the people of Israel of all kinds of sins. And Satan could say, Master of the universe, only yesterday, while Moses was receiving the law in heaven, they made for themselves a god of gold. What do they think? They dress in gold. They think that you forget the past. Oh yes, Satan is a good debater. And he's looking for great figures as personal targets. But hasn't the high priest Aaron taken part in the sad golden calf affair? But then it wasn't his entirely his fault, we are told in the Talmud. Satan contributed his part. While Moses was in heaven, while the people were waiting for his return, and he was late, Satan magically arranged that they saw a coffin-like object hanging in the air. The people concluded that their leader was dead. People panicked, and they lost hope, which led to loss of faith. So it was Satan's doing. We are told that the saintlier the person, the better target he is for Satan. Generations later, it is he who persuaded King David to transgress the heavenly order not to count the Jewish people. Yes, believe it or not, our tradition was against conducting a census. We are against polls. Why? Because human beings are not objects. They are not mathematical figures either. To dictators, human beings are replaceable, not in civilized societies. Their functions are replaceable, but not human beings. The fact is that David did organize a census, and the people were punished. 24,000 people lost their lives. David was reprimanded. Was Satan responsible for his error? Yes. Responsible for his tragic, immoral, and cruel romance with Bathsheba that cost the life of her husband, Uriah the Hittite? Yes. We are told, yes, Satan was responsible. But does it mean that David was not? Of course he was. Is Satan always there when we sin? Is it always his doing, not ours? But then where is the proverbial free will? Is it that Satan may try, but it's up to us to resist him? After all, who is greater than our ancestor Abraham, God's first ally and best friend, the only one of whom God asked to bring his beloved son as an offering? Was he ready to do it? I don't think so. But Satan thought otherwise, and he decided to intervene. His goal was to prevent the sacrifice of Isaac, period. Because he loved the son so much? No. Because he wished to hurt the father's faith. And so he did everything in his power to prevent Abraham from obeying God's awesome and strange, if on the surface cruel, commandment. First he tried to turn God against Abraham. When Isaac was born, the happy parents gave a party to celebrate the event. Certain sources say that the invited guests were the local notables and celebrities, which is normal. But then Satan appeared at the door, disguised as a beggar. Was he envious? Surely furious. "See," he said, turning to heaven, "I took a walk down below and happened to see your good friend Abraham celebrating. You were so kind to him, but he already forgot you. He hasn't bothered to bring you even the smallest, the cheapest offering. Now really, how ungrateful can he be?" And then God said, "What are you talking about? If I were to ask him for his son, he would surely give him to me." "Really?" said Satan. Let's see him do that. "Now really, I have always troubles with this. God's relations with Satan is something so strange and disturbing. Of all the angels, the best dialogues are between God and Satan." Listen, a midrash. As Abram journeyed towards Moriah, an old man appeared before him. It was Satan in disguise. He asked, "Where are you going?" "To prayer," said Abraham. With a knife? With a fire, stone, and wood? Nobody goes to prayer like that. Well, Abraham explained, we may be delayed a day or two. And we then would have to slaughter a lamb, place it on a fire to feed ourselves. It is best to be prepared. Thereupon Satan dropped his mask and said, poor old man, with your poor old days. Do you think you can fool me? Don't you know I was Miachorei Hapargot? I was present when the order was given. Abraham did not reply. Satan continued shouting, tell me, old man, have you lost your mind? Have you emptied your heart? Empty of all human feeling? Will you really sacrifice your son given to you at the age of 100? Yes, said Abraham, I shall. But tomorrow, old fool, God will demand more sacrifice, more cruelly yet. Will you be able to perform them too? I hope so, replied Abraham. I hope to always be able to obey God. But tomorrow, poor mortal, he may accuse you of murder. He who issued the order, he will condemn you for having killed your son. He will condemn you for having obeyed. Will you do it nevertheless? Yes, I shall, Abraham insisted. I shall do it anyway. I must obey him. That is my desire. Having failed with the father, Satan tried his luck with the son. He appeared before him disguised as a young boy. Where are you going? To study Torah, answered Isaac. Now or after your death? What a foolish question, said Isaac. Of course now. Don't you know that Torah is given only to the living? Poor son of a poor woman, said Satan. For years and years she lived in hope and prayer to give birth to you. And now this old man, your own father, has gone mad. Look at him. He's going to kill you, Isaac. Isaac would not believe him. Instead, he looked at his father with love. So Satan went on, feigning compassion. Yes, you are about to die, believe me. And do you know who will rejoice? Your brother Ishmael. He will be happy. Your clothes, your possessions, the gifts meant for you, he will get them all. And this argument, so childish, so human, gave Isaac pause. He turned to his father and shyly asked, look at this person, father. Listen to what he says. Don't pay any attention, son, said Abraham. His words are empty of meaning and truth. Do not listen. Now we have discovered one of Satan's major characteristics. He's a liar. Just a liar. Yes, but he lied to God. He lied to Abraham. He lied to Isaac. And at the end, he also half lied to Sarah. Again, listen to the Midrash. Having failed with father and son, he turned to the mother. She stood on the roof of her house, anxiously waiting for their return. And suddenly a man appeared before her and told her that her waiting was in vain. At this very moment, he said, the old man, your husband, knife in hand, is slaughtering your son. Fear-stricken, she let out a scream and fell from the ground, dead. In fact, Abram and God had a dialogue, had a quarrel, had a challenge. And who paid for it? Sarah. She's the only victim of this tale of fear and trembling. A liar who never tells the truth is less dangerous than the liar who at times tells the truth, or the half-truth, which is always a lie. Usually, Satan's work is directed against human beings, which, after all, is understanding and plausible. since that is meant to be his function. What is less comprehensible is his privilege of having unusual access to the Almighty. Yes, he has God's ear. Extreme examples, again, the case of both Abraham and Job. With no other biblical character is the Midrash so concerned about Satan's role in their trials. In both cases, it is Satan who initiates the endeavor. It is he who suggests that their faith be tested. Now, why should the judge of all judges, the Almighty King of Kings, the King of justice and compassion, why should he listen to Satan's arguments against his creatures, especially since God knows from the outset that they are vile and baseless? Strange as it may sound, the Zohar, the mystical book of splendor, makes an exception with precisely both Abraham and Job. The text in the portion of Pinchas quotes their stories as examples that Satan finds it easier to work on the just person than on others. Why? Probably because even a small transgression is endowed with a greater transcendental meaning when it is being done by a just man. With an average person who commits numerous small, not so small sins, each individual is less important. But the text continues, when the whole world is sinful and thus condemned to total punishment, God is using Satan to distract his attention by pointing at Abraham and Job. And so while Satan is busy with Abraham and Job, God saves the world from destruction. Again, how are we to grasp the meaning of all this? God is hiding from Satan, and we owe our survival to Satan? Admit it, and I must repeat, I insist on it. God's relationship with Satan does seem perturbing. In the Apocrypha, the devil came wearing the form and brightness of an angel. In secular culture, Satan's appearance is more appealing. The prince of darkness is a gentleman, according to our great Shakespeare. He has power to assume a pleasing shape. To Voltaire, the occasional atheist, he is the black sheep of the heavenly hosts. Without him, God's image would be pale, says he. The love of God, he says, is close to the fear of Satan. Heine calls him a handsome and charming man, a diplomat who talks glibly of church and state. Longfellow's description of Lucifer is remarkable. The son of mystery, he says. And since God suffers him to be, he too is God's minister and labors for some food, by us not understood. In other words, the devil is not necessarily a frightening monster with three eyes and four ears. He may be an amusing guest at a party. So God's agent, Satan? Do his power and legitimacy come from heavenly justice? Is his evil not absolute and not absolutely nefarious? Talmudic sages answer in the affirmative. They believe in his power and consider it dangerous always. They say only peace can vanquish Satan. And they insist, said Rabbi Eliezer, son of Rabbi Eliezer HaKapar, if all the pagan people and nations of the world were to live in peace, Satan would be powerless against them. Satan's heavenly role is also mentioned in the Talmud, said Rabbi Yossi. To whom may the angel Michael and Samael or Satan be compared? To a defender and a prosecutor standing before the tribunal. And that's all. And they simply say, of course, that Michael is better. But both of them plead their case, which means our fate, before God. Earlier, we suggested that Satan may come to us in disguise of a friend. Can that friend be God? Could he be his messenger, his instrument, as he was with Job? Goethe's Mephistopheles complains, part of that power am I, least understood, which always wills the bad and always works for the good. And more negatively, in Milton's Paradise Lost, the strongest and the fiercest spirit fought in heaven, now fiercer by despair. His trust was with the eternal to be deemed equal in strength, and rather than less cared not to be at all. Said Rabbi Levi, Satan meant well. When he heard from God how fond he was of Job, he grew worried. And what if Abram will be forgotten in comparison? And that is why he uttered terrible things about Job, so that God remembered Abram. Actually, says the Talmud, this story, a quasi-defense of Satan, was told by Rav Acha in the name of Rabbi Yaakov, the two famous Amoraim, in a public lecture given in a place named Paponia. And when Satan heard about it, he came and kissed his feet in gratitude. A pleasant yet surprising metaphor. In the Talmud, Satan is rarely, if at all, a human being. In a Breita of the 7th century, there is a certain evil character who is the son of Satan, who made love to a stone whose feminine beauty was stunning. But in later popular stories, he does wear human traits. Listen to a very disquieting Hasidic tale. When the future Rabbi Israel, the master of the good name, the Baal Shem Tov, was about to be born, Satan came running, breathless, to the heavenly court. Master of the universe, he cried, what are you doing, sending him down into the world? Don't you know what will happen? Everybody from all over will come to see and hear him, and the whole world will repent and follow your laws. And the Messiah will come. Is this what you want to happen now? Say so. Has the time arrived for universal redemption? No, said the Almighty. Redemption is still far away. Then stop, said Satan. Stop his soul from descending among your creatures. That I cannot do, said God. Once I gave the order for his soul to leave my special treasure box, it cannot be revoked. Then what will we do, asked Satan. I'll tell you what, answered the Almighty. Together with his soul, another soul will descend and enter a woman's womb. And that soul will have all the attributes of Rabbi Israel's wisdom and piety, compassion and erudition, kindness and intelligence. Both will apparently be endowed with the same divine powers. But only you and I will know that the second one belongs to you alone. Hearing this, Satan was satisfied, and I am not. What kind of game is this? Who is playing what? With all of us. What a terrifying story. Of all the legends, including those about Abraham and Job, this to me is the most worrisome. Could this really be God's will to make sure that none of us would ever be able to distinguish who is for good and who is for our common enemy? Having heard this tale, a student asked his teacher, if this is so, what must I do so as to avoid serving Satan? Don't listen to him, said the teacher. But what if I cannot avoid hearing him? It's simple, said the teacher. If his words suggest an easy way out, they are not mine. Let us skip centuries and move to common contemporary endeavors, recent ones. In a theater play situated in the mid-17th century, following a devastating pogrom, somewhere in Eastern Europe, God himself is being put on trial. An innkeeper, Berish, serves as prosecutor. A stranger performs as defense attorney, and both parts are poignant, for they recall into question certainties about the limitations of human justice and the mysterious components of divine compassion. And this is what we have in the text. Berish says, innkeeper, I, Berish, Jewish innkeeper at Shamgorod, accuse him of hostility, cruelty, and indifference. Either he dislikes his chosen people or he doesn't care about them, period. But then, why has he chosen us? Why not someone else for a change? Either he knows what's happening to us or he doesn't wish to know. In both cases, explain his guilt. And prosecutor answers, or the defense attorney says, guilty, no less, and you reach this conclusion by yourself. What can you give us as evidence? And Berish says, you need facts. What other facts do you want? What do you need? We are the facts. We are proof, living proof. Look at us. Look at us and you will know, you will understand. For we are the only ones one can still see in Shamgorod. The others are all invisible, absent, dead. Look at us. And Berish continues. Shamgorod. Last year, Shamgorod was a village with a Jewish community, a Jewish life. Shamgorod had a Jewish past and a Jewish future. Jewish warmth and Jewish songs could be found here in every street, in every house. Go look for them now. Shamgorod is mute. It's silence. What is it if not a fact? Three houses of study demolished, pillages. The main synagogue burned down. The sacred scrolls profaned. Aren't the ruins facts? Aren't the ashes glowing with facts? Over 100 Jewish families lived here. Now there is one, and this one is mutilated, maimed. And he says, he goes on, their descendants are facts, and they ask questions. And I am here to ask those questions. And strangely enough, the defender says, who are you to speak to God or about God like that? Who are you? Suffer? I know we suffer. Has haven't our ancestors suffered? The first temple was destroyed. The second temple was destroyed. And what did we say? Umipne chataynu. We have sinned. And you want to say something else? You want to say something else? What happened in Mainz? What happened in the Rhine province? All that happened was always pain, fear, suffering, death for God. And you now have the courage to speak against the descendants of the Crusades, of the survivors of the Crusades and the Holy Wars, of the pogroms. Does the massacre of Shamgorod weigh more than the burning of the sanctuary? Is the ruin of your home a more heinous crime than the ransacking of God's glory? Does the death of your community imply a greater meaning than the disappearance of the communities of Zhytomyr, Nemirov, Lutsk, and Berdychev? Who are you to make comparisons or draw conclusions? Born in dust, you are nothing but dust. And Berdych says, if he wanted me to be dust, why hasn't he left me as dust? But I am not dust. I am standing up. I am walking, thinking, wondering, shouting, I am human. It's a very, very disturbing play, because a lot of truth is being said on both sides. The anger of the victim and the plea of the one who defends God. But who is one who defends God? Turns out that one is really not God's friend. Berdych is. In conclusion, therefore, you go back to Satan. Satan, in fact, is a victim. In the Talmud, he is. At the end, he is pitied for his own manipulations. He is punished by himself. In the story of the binding of Isaac, he is the loser when God changes the rules of the game. In the book of Job, God allows Satan to torture Job, but not to take his life. God, therefore, is unfair to him, said Rabbi Yitzchak in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. In truth, the pain of Satan is more profound than the pain of Job. He compares Satan to a servant who is ordered by his master to break open a vessel and save the wine. So Satan, therefore, emerges as a victim. He vanishes without leaving a trace in the text in the book of Job. God's victim, then? God's martyr, perhaps? Is this why his shadow could be found in the heart of man? I believe that no one is perfect. And of course the question is God's justice perfect? Beware of those who unconditionally justify someone else's suffering. Job's so-called friends were reprimanded by God. To question God's justice or compassion is permitted and sometimes demanded, provided it is done within faith. In other words, really no one can be or must be perfect. Maimonides prohibits us, orders us not even to try. No one's deed or thought is absolute, nor is his or her fate. For in certain circumstances, fate itself can be wounded. Wounded by Satan, perhaps by those who in the past have done in his name, in the name of perverse ideologies and poisoned beliefs, more than Satan. Whatever the situation, I favor the art of questioning. But remember, the question of the believer is painful. That of the non-believer is less. So who is Satan? If something of Satan is in all of us, who is he? Who am I to comprehend his power over God's creatures? How far does that power reach? Is it conceivable that Satan's real ambition is not only to conquer the heart and mind of man, but also the throne of God? Isn't this what happened last century, when half of the world was dominated by such evil? And that evil was not only addressed at the humanity of man. The fact is that evil and those who represented evil and worked for evil and manipulated evil actually wanted to conquer God's throne in our heart. At times one may wonder, was Satan's real ambition really only to pervert Abraham or Job or any one of us? Has his rebellion continued throughout the ages, some of them filled with darkness and sorrow? Oh, we don't know. We often wonder where God was during that time. I don't know where. I surely know where Satan was. But wait a second. If Satan is Satan, Satan must have a Satan. Who was Satan's Satan? And where is Satan in history? Who still believes in him today? I don't know. I do know that those who believed in him yesterday and before, were not the innocent victims accused of heresy, but their accusers in the Middle Ages and later. They who persecuted, tormented, and killed human beings, Jews and Gentiles, for being members of so-called Satan's synagogue. They, the victims, were victims, but the victimizers worshipped Satan. The inquisitors were not only cruel, but also senseless. They too believed that Satan existed. So I don't know where Satan is today, but I do know that whoever works to separate human beings from one another, whoever allows persons to be victims of destiny or hostages of society, for whatever reason, whoever invokes theory to diminish the humanity that we embody, whoever lies, cheats, in order to diminish and humiliate another person, that person can be neither my ally nor my friend.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard the second of three lectures in the annual series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture was titled, In the Talmud and Other Sources, Satan in Ancient Memories. Introducing Professor Wiesel was Dr. Paula Friedman, Associate Dean at the Boston University Goldman School of Dental Medicine. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Jared Mooney and Ryan Peterson. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Steve Brown. Thanks for joining us.